is The Guardian.
I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
We have veggie smoothies for breakfast every morning, or at least we used to.
Like millions of other Australians, lately, Guardian Australia staffers have been noticing something odd when doing their essential shopping.
For the last week and a half, we've been checking grocery stores nearby every single day for frozen broccoli and cannot find it anywhere.
I've got a rescue dog and she likes to eat her peanut butter on my couch, and she always gets peanut butter stains on my couch. And I rely on this deep cleaning foam, which promises to remove 5 times more dirt than vacuuming alone. And I can't get it anywhere.
Our salads have been pretty bare the past week. No onion, no tomato, potatoes, broccoli. They're all a thing of the past.
We actually chose the type of baby formula that we give our son because we thought it would be the easiest to come by if ever there was a shortage. It was 5 different supermarkets before we were able to actually come back with a couple of tins of formula, 2 different sorts of nappies that we needed. It was really just a matter of driving all over Brisbane supermarket to supermarket and eventually just striking it lucky.
Both Coles and Woolworths have limited sales of painkillers to 2 packs per person.
Guardian Australia's senior business reporter, Ben Butler, has been taking a close look at this issue.
The real focus of this crisis is along the East Coast. It's across the entire supermarket industry that dominate food retailing in Australia, and they have long and complicated supply chains that have really been busted up by the Omicron wave.
He says the reason this is all happening has to do with a big shift in Australia's COVID-19 strategy, and how this shift is impacting supply chains.
It's a very delicately balanced system that relies on everything working all the time. And it's kind of, you know, a daily miracle that that happens normally. And it's just not happening now.
Today, what's behind Australia's supply chain crisis? It's Friday, the 21st of January. Okay, so a pretty obvious big question for you then is, why are we seeing such shortages?
So this summer we've had the Omicron variant, which is highly contagious, lead to a massive surge in cases. As a result of that, we've seen 2 things. Firstly, a return to panic buying, which we've seen before in the pandemic. It's not a new thing. Toilet paper, you know, being stripped from the shelves, that kind of stuff. The second thing, which is pretty new, is issues with the supply chain, which is what it says on the box. It's the chain of businesses and workers that get supplies from their producer to you. So what's happened is that all along the supply chain, there's just not enough staff. So it's from end to end. You know, there are problems in the whole supermarket supply chain. You start at the farm. There's not so many problems on the farm as yet, but still there are problems picking and packing things like fruit. If we're looking at meat, abattoirs are backed up. They can't slaughter all the animals. That's why pork is in such short supply, for example. Then we go through the trucks that needed things, get things from those sort of producers to supermarket distribution centres. Truckies, up to half the truckies can be off at a time at some places. In the distribution centres themselves, again, Coles tells me that up to half the staff are off sometimes. And, you know, anecdotally, it runs at consistently at about a quarter of staff being off due to COVID. And then, again, you've got trucks that need to get things to the supermarkets themselves, and then problems in the actual supermarkets with stocking the shelves with staff off in the shop. It's a very delicately balanced system that relies on everything working all the time. And it's kind of, you know, a daily miracle that that happens normally. And it's just not happening now.
Why is this happening now? I mean, we did see a lot of cases in earlier Delta waves. Is it just the sheer amount of cases that we're seeing in this Omicron wave?
Yeah. So people in industry say that the number of cases is just overwhelming. That's one factor. The other factor is that there's less public health restrictions and less support for workers, the kind of things that would encourage them to stay home while they're sick. People are able to spread it much more easily, and that drives into the number of cases that you see, and also means that it's really hard to get the virus out of your workplace once it's in.
As a business reporter, when you see this large amounts of staff off sick, empty shelves, what do you think?
This is a really significant economic crisis. Food shortages are one really, really important part of this, but the problem is really broad. In the past waves, businesses have had things like JobKeeper payments to keep them afloat, and for unemployed people, JobSeeker was increased dramatically. But there's none of that support available today. So, you know, we were told no more lockdowns and we're opening up. And it was entirely predictable and predicted that this would cause a huge jump in cases that would have to be dealt with. And it is caused by, in large part, a change in policy from National Cabinet, you know, driven by people who wanted to see the economy boom again and don't seem to have properly thought through the consequences of their choices for workers and businesses.
I just want to start by being very upfront with Australians that I can assure you that I and all the members of my government understand just how frustrating this summer has been for Australians. The Omicron variant has caused great disruption. You've seen queues, you've seen rising cases, you've seen pressures on hospital systems, you've seen disruption of supply chains, you've seen all of these all around the world. But that is of no comfort to Australians, and that is something that we must continue to work together to push through.
Right, this does seem like a fairly logical conclusion to, you know, moving from an approach where we lock down when there's only a handful of cases in a state to keeping businesses open when there's tens of thousands of cases each day. But that approach has a really big problem. You need workers who are well to keep businesses open. So how have state governments and the federal government tried to resolve that problem, Ben?
Yeah, you can't run a healthy economy off the back of a sick workforce. It's physically impossible, and neglecting the physical constraints of reality is a problem. The attempts to deal with this have mainly focused around trying to free up capacity immediately so that we can have people at work today. And that's basically been things like...
We extended the easing of restrictions for close contacts. So that's the one which enables someone who may be a close contact, they get a negative RAT test and go straight back to work.
Allowing people to go back to work immediately after being a close contact but testing negative rather than isolating for 7 days, which was previously the policy.
They don't have to isolate for that period. They just go straight back to work.
And before Christmas also changed the definition of close contact so that only included people you'd been around for 4 hours or more in a household context. We'd previously been a lot broader than that.
Okay, that's when you're a close contact. You're not a close contact because you happened to be here today and one of you might have COVID.
In early January, New South Wales said that workers in agriculture, food logistics, transport and manufacturing who were close contacts and already in isolation would be allowed to come back if their employer said it would be a high risk of disruption to the delivery of critical services or activities, and they were required to wear a mask and do daily rapid antigen tests, which actually are pretty standard across all these kinds of injuries for all workers. But any worker who tests positive or develops symptoms was to self-isolate. In Queensland, there were some additional conditions where protective equipment, be vaccinated and use private transport to and from work. You're also required to be vaccinated in Victoria. Then mid-January, after National Cabinet, the Prime Minister announced new rules that meant more workers in more industries who were close contacts would be able to go to work.
The most immediate extension of that is to all transport, freight and logistics employees. It will cover all health, welfare, care and support. Emergency services, which includes law enforcement.
Correct. He said that the existing sort of loosening of the rules was already having a positive impact.
But we need to go further.
In a further kind of loosening of the rules, Morrison called on the states to scrap the requirement for people to be get a RAT test every morning.
There are other changes that need to be made, and they're at a state level, and I'm continuing to pursue those with the states. There are changes that we need to make around the age of forklift drivers, to get quite specific.
Morrison also called on the states to allow children, that's people under 18, to drive forklifts to ease the staff shortages in warehouses. That's normally not allowed because forklifts, as well as being incredibly useful, are an incredibly dangerous piece of industrial machinery. They're really big, they're really heavy, they're prone to tip, crush and collision injuries. But that, nonetheless, is one of Scott Morrison's big ideas to ease the squeeze.
I highlight these to you to demonstrate the level of detail that the government is working through to ensure that we can try and alleviate all of the challenges that we're facing right across the workforce.
You can really see the sort of state of policy on the run here. Despite claiming things are getting better, apparently more and more measures are needed basically every week to try and get people back to work.
To return to school in the coming weeks, the Prime Minister is due to hold a media conference to detail the results of that National Cabinet meeting. That's due to happen anytime now. We'll go live to Canberra as soon as Scott Morrison appears.
I took the industry proposals that had come from our consultation in the transport sector for discussion at National Cabinet today. We agreed to proceed no further with the issue of 16-year-old forklift drivers. It's a matter raised with the industry. We had a good discussion about it today, and that is not something that we believe collectively that should be pursued at this time.
Look, kids driving forklifts is probably one of the most bizarre solutions to a workforce shortage I've heard of for a long time. But I want to narrow in on this idea of allowing workers who are close contacts to go back to work after just taking something like a RAT test. You can see how this opens the door for sick and infectious workers to be coming to work. How have people responded to this?
Yeah, so obviously RAT tests are less reliable tests than PCR tests. So that means you will get people who have COVID being at work when they weren't before as a matter of mathematical inevitability. So this went down like a lead balloon with the union movement. The acting ACTU Secretary, Liam O'Brien, said it would exacerbate the highly infectious Omicron strain and put the safety of all Australians at risk. The Transport Workers Union National Secretary, Michael Caine, said it was reckless and removed the last buffer we had to protect workplaces. Industry was pretty much in favour, as you might imagine, when they're sort of screaming out for bodies on the floor. The Australian Fresh Produce Alliance, which represents the fruit and veg industry, had been asking for 7-day isolation requirement for close contacts who test negative to be scrapped to get people back to work because they were worried about fruit and veg going off. And the Meat Industry Council had basically asked for the same thing. So it really has been an employer-employee divide on this issue.
Mm. What about testing? As we know, RAT tests are incredibly hard to find. It's like a black market at the moment out there. Are businesses able to get all the RAT tests that they need for this new regime?
Yeah, so this is quite variable. At the big end of town, big business has been able to get RAT tests. They've largely managed to secure a supply. They've got a lot of purchasing power, so they're able to do that. The problem is in the small to medium enterprises where they don't have that level of purchasing power, and they're the ones who've been asking for free RATs to test their workers, something that Morrison has consistently said is not going to happen.
How do workers feel about this system? Do we have a sense, outside of these union statements, how this is all playing out on the ground?
Yes. I've spoken to someone who works in the coal supply chain. He told me that conditions in the warehouse are the most difficult they've seen in the pandemic so far. They have to do multiple RATs a day sometimes to ensure they test negatives. Sometimes that means they have to do a PCR test as well, which is a lot more intrusive than a RAT. The employees are doing really long hours, 12 hours. Some shifts have been moved back to 2 a.m. rather than starting at 6 a.m. I mean, warehouses run 24 hours, but people are doing unfamiliar early shifts. He said that management were behaving like demented chooks and that they were sitting on their hands in that they don't really know what to do.
Mm.
And he was skeptical about these moves allowing workers back to work after a negative test to having any effect, because most people off at the moment actually have COVID. So in response to this, Coles says things are really, really tough, and they do say it is the toughest it's been in the pandemic. But they say they did hire more people in advance of December, and they did stock up at the same time. But the scale of the Omicron wave is just too big for any possible contingency plan to deal with.
Next, going to work while sick with COVID. So, as you mentioned, unions and others are worried that this will mean that infectious and infected staff are going to work. Has that happened, as far as we know?
We know of one case where it's definitely happened.
Mm.
South Australia Health has allowed at least one abattoir that we know of to operate with infected staff at work. Gave it an abattoir run by Tees Australia, a very large meat supplier in Australia, near Narrakoot in South Australia, an exemption allowing infected staff to come to work if they weren't showing symptoms.
So this is not just close contacts that we're talking about here who may be infected. This is actually a step further, literally allowing infected workers to go to work as long as they weren't, you know, actively coughing or sneezing.
That's right. Although we know one employee at least has said some sick staff worked and showed symptoms. So workers who were COVID positive got white hairnets and negative ones got yellow ones, but they were all in the same space without any special air filters, even though they did give the COVID positive workers face masks, balaclavas and gloves, and they were still all using the same toilet. It was one of the most desperate things that we've seen so far in the pandemic. In a statement, T said that any staff in critical roles who tested positive were already approved by SA Health to return to work if they didn't have symptoms and had isolated for 7 days. They said that contrary to misleading claims made in the public domain, no worker had been or would be forced to work if they are unwell. And they said that the health and safety of Tees Australia's people always comes first.
I can't imagine the unions were happy with this. What have people said?
They were pretty much outraged. They said this was completely unacceptable. And, you know, what the whole thing led to was on the Sunday, Woolworths, which had been supplied by the abattoir, stopped taking meat from it. But then Woolworths later announced it would resume processing meat from the abattoir from today.
So, Ben, as you mentioned, broadly, it seems that we are in the middle of a massive shift here. We're moving away from a system where the government forks out money to keep the system afloat via things like COVID sick payments and JobKeeper, and towards what some have described as a keep everything open at all costs approach. Some people have seen that as sacrificing worker welfare and rights for the good of the overall economy. But is this actually good for the economy?
Well, it isn't, because lots of things are actually shut. The economy is not an abstract thing that floats above our lives, reflected in some figures every couple of months on what GDP did or whatever, right? It's the relationship between us all of how we live our lives. So it can't prosper on the back of a workforce that is sick. And it's really been that simple. Businesses say this is the worst wave they've ever experienced. You know, they have no JobKeeper, they have no cash flow boost payments, they have little of the state-based support that they previously enjoyed. It's a bit of a desolate wasteland because at the same time as everything is technically open, many people are staying home in what's become an unofficial lockdown and try to avoid, you know, very contagious COVID variant. And that has, you know, smashed other areas of business, not just the supermarkets. Consumer confidence is at a 30-year low. Many shops are empty. Hospitality and tourism is really struggling. Now, often they have staff shortages as well, and then there's not any customers. Spending is down on transport and recreation. We have some credit card data from the Commonwealth Bank. It's out recently on that. It's up on things you buy in the supermarket and medicines, you know. So it's a really mixed picture in terms of what people are doing. They're not going out. They are staying home and ordering stuff online.
When will we get a sense of the economic impact of this time?
We'll get some sense of whether people have gone to work and in what numbers in figures out in February from the Bureau of Statistics. But the problem with all those kind of data is that it's the situation's moving so quickly that it's out of date almost immediately. Jim Stanford, economist at the Centre for Future Work, was on the ABC and said that he expected 1/3 of workers in New South Wales could be in isolation over the coming weeks. There's also another looming issue, which is that although many politicians are hopeful that the peak is nowish, there's a lot of people return to work after Australia Day and because of school holidays ending and then coming back to work. And also the construction industry, which is about 10 to 12% of the economy and of the workforce, comes back from its summer break then as well. And so these fresh avenues of infection will open up.
Mm. So we could see this worsen over the next 2 months.
You know, you hope that our leaders have it right in their prediction that the end is near and that things will get better soon. But there are really big risks out there on the horizon.
As you said, this is a crisis. If it doesn't abate, if workers continue to be sick, if there's no food on the shelves, what could we see next in terms of policy? What do you think the government might do?
Well, you know, there's an election coming. All the polls show that the government's on the nose. View of the handling of the COVID crisis has really dropped off a cliff amongst the population. I wouldn't rule out a return to some kind of payment to help people and businesses get through. The Morrison government has really started again with this kind of rhetoric of, you know, personal responsibility and being a better economic manager. But it doesn't mean anything if people's lived experience is that everything's in ruins around them.
That was Ben Butler, Guardian Australia's senior business reporter. He's done a bunch of reporting on this issue, including a piece earlier this week where you hear from that Coles warehouse worker in a bit more detail. It's called Chronic Staff Shortages, 2 a.m. Starts and Extreme Anxiety Inside a Coles Supermarket Supply Warehouse. We've also put some links to his reporting on the Full Story page. This episode was produced by Jake Morecambe, Miles Herbert and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design. The executive producers of Full Story are Gabrielle Jackson, Miles Martignoni and me, Laura Murphy-Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a rating or a review if you're listening on an app that has that function. We are constantly trying new things and trying to make episodes better for you, and those reviews do help. Okay, catch you next week.